Okay, we're on Tanya, the Geras HaKadosh, the Holy Letter, page 302, with the numbering system at the top, and it's chapter 31. Just a bit of introduction about Tanya, since you've not learned it before. Have you learned any Hasidic teachings at all before?
No.
Basically, the Torah, when it was given on four different levels. And the acronym for the four different levels is Paradis. Paradis literally means an orchard, but each letter stands for a different part of the Torah. Pei stands for Pshat. Pshat means the ordinary, literal meaning. You can read it, the Bible's translated into English, and you can read it as a story. Then you have Resh, which stands for Remez, which means hints. So within the text, you've got hints. So numerical values of letters would be perhaps included in this, hinting to something in particular. Then you have the Dalet, Paradis, then it comes a Dalet. That stands for Drush. Drush, the official translation of Drush is homiletics. What it means is derivation of meaning that isn't obvious from the text.
Okay.
Perhaps a word over here, a similar word is used over there, so you compare the context and learn something out. That would be drash or drush. And finally you have the samach, which stands for sod. Sod in Hebrew means secret. So we understand from this that there are deeper levels of Torah on the level of secrets, and it's something that has to be delved into. And also it's connected with Kabbalistic teachings. And Kabbalah, the word Kabbalah means received. That means Kabbalah can't just be made up and derived yourself. You can't think these things up. It has to be something that's taught by a teacher who's familiar with the teachings of Kabbalah and the esoteric part of the Torah. And then one can start to understand the concepts. So Hasidic teachings are on that level of sod. What the point about the Hasidic teachings is, it is taking these deep ideas, which are difficult to understand, and expressing them in a form that a person can understand them using ordinary intellect. Once upon a time, before the Hasidic movement developed, the Kabbalistic teachings were the domain of only certain individuals who were able to relate to the teachings. The ordinary man in the street didn't understand them. Because, you know, the language, it was couched in a kind of esoteric language, using parables and so on. But then the founder of the Hasidic movement, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, he started to reveal these teachings in a way that could be understood by the ordinary man. But the one that really developed that to a great extent was the founder of the Lubavitch dynasty, and that was Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi. That was the town he lived in. He didn't actually live in Lubavitch as a leader.
He's the Alter Rebbe, no?
Pardon?
Is he the Alter Rebbe?
The Alter Rebbe, yeah. He was the one to really bring these teachings down to the level of understanding. And that's why his teachings are called Chabad. Chabad stands for Chochma Bina Das, which means wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. So what he's saying by that is to bring down these deep teachings to a level where you can use your mind, it can be analyzed, it can be understood, it can be discussed. And the Bible of those teachings is this book, which is variously named Likutei Amorim, which means collected sayings, or it's called Tanya, after the first word of the first page, or it's called Sefer Shel Beinonim, which means the book of the average Jew, which he explains isn't really average at all, but we're not doing that part at the moment. Anyway, eventually, over time, this was published at the end of the 18th century, around about 1798-99, that sort of period. And then it was republished again in the early 19th century, and it's been printed up again. But as time went on, more was added, more of his teachings were added, so that there are, in fact, five sections of it now. And we're now learning the fourth section, which is basically a collection of letters, which is pastoral letters, which he sent out to his followers, which contain within them deep teachings. Many of them centered around the concept of giving charity. In this particular section, he goes to coach. Okay, so that's a very, very quick resume background to what this book is all about. I'd just like to add one point, which is that on the frontispiece, the very first page, he says that the aim of this book is to explain what it says in the Chumash. It says in Sedra Nitzavim, that which is near the end of the Chumash, that the Torah is, don't say that the Torah is far away. That, you know, don't say the Torah is in heaven, that we have to go up to heaven to get it. Don't say it's on the other side of the sea, that we'll have to somehow travel to get it. No. Ki korav elecha adava ma'od, beficha v'vavcha lasosa. That the matter is very near to you. In your mouth, beficha in your mouth, v'vavcha, and in your heart, lasosa, to do it. So, in your mouth is speech, in your heart is feeling, and intellectualization, and to do it is action. So that's thought, speech, and deed. So what he's saying is the Torah is very easy to keep in thought, speech, and deed. So he says on the frontispiece, I want this book to explain how it's easy to keep the Torah in thought, speech, and deed. And that's his stated aim. And I've often repeated this mashal, which is brought, this parable, which is brought to explain how something which is really hard can be seen easy. Mm-hmm. And the mashal is brought of a person who is an old man who's carrying a heavy sack of stones. For whatever reason, maybe he's in the building trade. So he's got this terribly heavy sack, it's a hot day, he's climbing up a hill, he's schwitzing, he's sweating, his knees are buckling, and he's going up the hill, and someone by the side says, you know, to the old man, you know, you've got this stack of stones in you over here, do you want another stone? So the guy's, you know, expletive deleted, you know, the guy's going to go mad. You can't see I'm struggling with these stones, you're giving me another one? Okay, that's scenario number one. Scenario number two. The same old man, the same hot day, the same hill, the same sack, but instead of being full of stones, it's full of gold nuggets. Okay. And someone by the side says, hey, old man, you're carrying this sack, you're shitting, you're sweating, it's a hot day, you're carrying these gold nuggets, do you want another one? He says, yeah! So what's the difference? The weight's the same, the heat's the same, the hill's the same, the old man's the same, and in one case he didn't want it, and in another case he was yearning for it.
There's more reward, there's much more reward.
The answer is, there's no doubt we're carrying the load. Mm-hmm. God has given us a burden. He's given us a duty. He's given us the Torah, which is, there's a Yiddish saying, Yisrael Tzana Yid, it's hard to be a Jew. Mm-hmm. Why? Because we've got so much to do. A Jew has to get up in the morning, and you've got to go running to shul and put your tefillin on, and then you go for your breakfast, then you have to learn some Torah, then you go for your breakfast, you have to make a bracha before, make sure the food is kosher, and then if you're having bread, you have to wash and make another bracha, and then afterwards you have to say Birchas Hamazon, you bench, and let me go to work already. You know, I've got to do all these before I even start going to work. And then Hasidim do even more. They go to the mikveh. I mean, this is a burdensome kind of life. Compare it to, you know, what most people do. The answer is, you'll only see it as a burden if you don't see the value. But if you see the tremendous value that there is, then the burden no longer seems a burden. Now, we find this in everyday life, that, you know, there are certain people who are driven by a certain goal or aim, and they themselves say, you know, people say, oh, how did you manage to work so many hours and to train so hard? And I didn't find it so hard, you know. I love this sport, you know. Like someone that's a great swimmer or a great footballer, they love the sport. They wouldn't do it if they didn't. So the training is not a big burden for them because they love it. So it depends how much you love it, how much you see the value of it. So this is his dedicated aim. Is that when we start reading this book, we start to see the value of a mitzvah, Ah, now you're talking about something else. It's not a burden anymore. It's a privilege. It's an investment. Right? We're getting more out of it than we're putting in. So now I can approach it with a completely different attitude of positiveness. Okay, that's the general background. We're now going to dive straight in to a piece over here. So chapter 31, Moida Bashorim. It's literally, that means it's known in the gates. That means it's well known, Mashikosa B'tikunim, what it writes in the holy Zohar, otherwise known as Tikunim, because there is a part of the Zohar called the Tikune Zohar. The Zohar is a great work of Kabbalistic teachings that was written about 2,000 years ago by the great Tanna of the Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, one of the greatest sages of all time. And he writes there, the Shchinta I Mara Begalusa, Kiviyachal. Shchinta means the divine presence. The root of the word is Lishkon, which means to dwell, the indwelling of God's presence in us. So the idea behind it is that God relates to us, to people generally, and to the Jewish people in particular. And that relationship with us, it's like an indwelling, it's like a close relationship. So it's called Shechina. Because God can be seen as very remote, and he can be seen as very close. He might be remote, he might be close, it depends on us. If we don't welcome him into our lives by living according to his teachings, then he's remote. But if we bring him into our lives, then he wants to be near, and he is near, and he dwells amongst us. And therefore he's called Shekhinah. It's Iyim Marabigalusa. The Shekhinah pastures in the exile. What does it mean, pastures? Well, it's using it as a parable. But what it means is that the divine presence is also in exile, which is a very powerful concept. He uses the word the kaviyachal, which means so to speak, because obviously we've got to be careful when we're talking about God not to attribute to him limitations which he doesn't have. So if we talk about God dwelling down below, is that to the exclusion that he doesn't dwell above? No, he dwells above and he dwells below. If we say God is far, does that mean to say he's not near? That there's a possibility that he's only far and not near? The answer is no, he's everywhere. But the question is, how does he manifest himself? How much does he show himself? There lies the difference. Sometimes he shows himself to be near, and sometimes he shows himself not to be not near. Like the Torah says, that God says, I will hide my face on that day. So he's saying, I'm really there. But it's like a person who's there, but they hide their face. They're not interested in talking to you, so they hide their face. They're there, but they're not there. So God can show himself more or less, and that's what we mean by him being near or not near. But really, he's everywhere. The same thing over here. When we talk about the divine presence is in exile. Well, God goes in exile, you know. What does exile mean? You're away from home. Is he away from home? Does he have a home? You know?
Is it not more because of our limitations, though? It's, you know, Hashem is everywhere, but we don't. It's, you know, by fulfilling mitzvah and doing stuff.
That's right. That's right. It's a reflection. What he does is what we do. This is a statement that was made by the Alter Rebbe's Rebbe, who was called Rabbi Dov Ber of Mezerich. And he basically said that it says in Pirkei Avos, Da Mashalem Alamimcha, know what is above you. And the Mishnah goes on to tell us what is above us. Yeah, so he said, no, don't read it like that. And I've got another way of reading it. Da mashalamala. Know that what is above, what's happening in heaven, mimcha, it's from you. What you do down here, that affects what happens up there. And it also says another passage which says, Hashem tzilcha, God is your shadow. Or you could, a better way, or more immediate ways to understand it as being a reflection. God is our reflection. So again, like a shadow or reflection does what we do. Mm-hmm. You stand in front of the mirror and you go like that, so the guy in the mirror will go like that as well. So it says that there's one of the sayings of the Torah is that God says to us, Im tazveni yom yomayim ezveka, if you leave me for one day, I'll leave you for two. So the commentaries ask, how can it be that God normally does measure for measure? If we sort of do one measure, he does the other measure. So it's only one for one. This seems to be two for one. He says, if you leave me for one day, I'll leave you for two. So the mashal, the parable that's used is, if someone's standing in front of a mirror, if I step back a pace, the image steps back a pace, and the distance between us is two paces. So what it means is, when God says, I will, if you leave me for one day, I'll leave you for two, he didn't really leave us for two, he only left us for one. But the distance between us is two, because he reflects what we do. So when we talk about God being far, he's far because we've gone far. When we talk about God being near, he's near because we went near to him. He reflects us. So when it says that God is in exile, it's because we're in exile. So God makes himself in exile as well, so to speak. He makes himself as if in exile. What does it mean he makes himself as if in exile? Well, it says about us being in exile that we are acting as if we're asleep. In exile, it says, Ani Yushena Valibier, it says in Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, I'm asleep, but my heart is awake. And the Jewish people are talking. So the rabbis say, the Jewish people are saying, Ani Yushena Begalusa, I'm asleep in my exile. Meaning that when we're in exile, we're not fully acting as proper Jewish, as the way Jews ought to act. Just like a person who's asleep does not behave in the way a human being is supposed to act, because they're asleep. So the Jewish people are like that. We're in exile. We're not doing things the way we ought to. So Vavilibier, really deep down inside us, my heart's awake, meaning my soul is still alive and doing, you know, and there and wanting to express itself, but it's sort of trapped in the body and unable to express itself. So God also feigns sleep. And in that sense, he's also in exile. He feigns sleep. He doesn't react to us. He hides his face. It's all connected. Yeah. Is Pirush al derech Moshel, k'may choli aguf, hamavdu ben kodesh l'chol, v'chulu, it says v'chulu, etc. So it says, he uses an example of the illness of the body. Shesibus ha-choli v'abiyas hi, hispashus v'hilech ha-chayas me'alev al-kol ha-evorim. The cause or the reason why a person is ill or why a person is well is the efficiency or the correctness of the way the life force from the heart is spread out through all the limbs. Hamlebeshes bedam nefesh ayetzimelev, and the limbs are bathed by blood, and in the blood there is the soul, as it says in the Torah. Ki adamo anafesh, the blood has got the soul within it.
It's got the whole principle of keeping kosher, isn't it? It's one of the main ones that, you know, that's why we always...
The food affects, yeah, you are what you eat.
But the same with the animal, though. We have no right, because it's on the blood of another level that, you know, we can't really... You know, hence the complete bleeding of an animal before it completes.
Not to have the blood, yeah. We shouldn't take in animal blood, because that would have an effect on our behavior. So the blood goes out of the heart into all the limbs. And the blood circulates. And it takes with it the spirit of life. And also the blood into the innards of every limb. The agidim and the sinews, or that could mean the veins and arteries, which are in the limbs. The chayze al alev, and then the blood goes back to the heart. V'imsivu v'hilu charua chayim halos. So with this circulation of the spirit of life, which is going coursing through the body with the blood, hu kil chosay tamidi kesidroi hamasudala mechaya chayim baruch hu. If that circulation is working the way it ought to, the way it's been organized by the God, the blessed be he, who is the source of all life, Azayah Adam Bari Bataknis, then the person's completely healthy. Ki chola evarim mekushorim yachad, for then all the limbs are connected properly, umekablim chayusam aroy lahem me'alev, and they receive their life force that they need from the heart. So in each limb, of course, has got its own needs. We know that the blood is an unbelievable complexity, and it bathes each limb and cell. We're even going back down to cellular level. Each cell takes the nutrients from the blood that it needs, and different cells need different things, and then that's what he's talking about here. It's all brought about through this circulation of the blood, bringing the life and the force to each part of every limb. Ach im yesh eizer kilto be'ezer mekayma. But if there's something wrong in some way in the body, and the kilkel means something that's spoiled or wrong, hamoneo ma'akev, that prevents or blocks the circulation, I'm a ma'itzivuv, v'ilach adam, or it reduces the flow, think of a blood clot or something, imaruach chayim ha'malubishpo, and it therefore prevents the spirit of the life force, which is in the blood, from reaching that limb, as I nifsuk, I mismayit ha'kesha alaz, and mekash kol evorim, El Aleph, then the connection between that limb and the heart is either fully broken or at least reduced. And normally the connection with that limb and that part of the limb is connected with the heart through the circulation, but now that that limb doesn't get the blood supply the way it ought to, that limb is suffers. V'azai naifal adam lemishka v'choli Hashem yirachim. And then the person will fall to his bed with illness. God should have mercy upon us. So, you know, nowadays we're very conscious of heart attacks and things like that.
DVT as well. I mean, it's
DVT, what's it called? Deep vein thrombosis, blood clots and so on. So, the person can get gangrene because the blood didn't go to that limb. And exactly as described over here. So when the flow of blood, which is the life force in the body, isn't flowing the way it ought to, the result can be very dire. V'kacha mamash al derech moshel, so this is a parable. Hine, kol nishmas Yisrael nikraim b'chinas eved ishchinta. So we, the souls of all the Jewish people, we are called the limbs of the divine presence, and nikras b'shem lev, which is called heart, that God is the heart of all the Jewish people. In this parable, the reason is because all the souls of all the Jewish people are part of God. So whatever's animating every single Jew is a kind of manifestation of God. It's sort of like there's a flow from God Himself through a system, and this system arrives in this individual Jew. And the Jew is connected with God that way, and he's healthy spiritually. Yeah, so. And the divine presence is like compared to the heart. Says in Tehillim, God is Tzur is my rock. So God is very often described as my rock, because a rock is something sort of steady and steadfast, something you can hold on to and stop yourself being blown away or washed away. Or you know, the rock is the firm basis for a person's life. And this is what Torah and mitzvahs are. Because we're connecting ourselves with God through the Torah and its mitzvahs, that gives us a stable life. Why is it we see such instability in the world, in people's lives? And, you know, people, whatever they do, you know, it lasts for a while and it doesn't seem to have permanence and stability, is because they're not connected with anything stable. The only thing that's truly stable in life, both physical and spiritual, is God Himself. He's called the Tzur, the rock. So when you're connected with the rock, you're not subject to the currents that are flowing in the sea of life. So God is described as this rock, and the Tzur Levavi. So it means He's like a heart. And God Himself says in last week's Sedra, V'asali mikdosh v'shechanti b'seichem, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell in them. Not in it, but in them. That means God's dwelling in each and every one of us. Pirish. Ki loshen shechina hu shahar ava shaychin b'ilomis b'ya'alach yaisam. The word shechina, as I said earlier at the beginning, the word shechina, the root of it is the word lishkon, which means to dwell within. So that's why it's called Shechina. So what it means is God is dwelling within all the worlds. Notice he says an abbreviation, Beis Yud Ayin, which stands for Bria Yetzira Asiya, which we haven't got time to explain it all now, but there are different levels of spiritual worlds. There are different spiritual worlds which they themselves are on different levels. The levels are measured by closeness to God, or measured by how much God is manifest in those worlds, or revealed in those worlds. The lower the world, the less God is manifest. Until we get down to this world, which is called the world of Asiya, which is the world of practicality, where God is not manifest much at all. And the proof of that is that you've got millions of people walking around that don't think of God from one end of the earth to the other. So that means there's nothing forcing them to think of God, which means God isn't manifesting himself. Of course, we know that God is acts in a way that when you look for him, you find him, and if you don't look for him, you don't find him. It's sort of a self-perpetuating situation. So those that look for him do find him, and those that don't bother looking for him think he's not there. But that's an aside. So God is dwelling within all of these worlds, la'achiyasim, to give them life. So how is God giving life to all the worlds? First of all, by him enclosing himself in the souls of the Jewish people. Because all the other created beings are incomparable to God. In other words, they're so low, the other beings, that there's no like connecting link between them and God. They're on too low a level. So there has to be something that's a link between them and God, and that is the souls of the Jewish people, which are called the Chelek Elokam Imal, which are actually part of God. So that's a good link, because it's part of God, and it's inside the body of every Jew. So we can be a link to the world. Because everything in the created world, or all of the worlds, are reckoned as naught compared to God. The word kalah can either mean as naught, or it can also mean a speck of dust. So it can mean kalah. La is a speck of dust in the air. So all it means is that God is so great, however great a creation he makes, all of it is nothing compared to him. So this great universe in which we live is all, as far as he's concerned, he himself, it's kalach, it's just like a speck of dust. I mean, do you take any notice of these little specks of dust in the air that you, in sunlight, you can see them floating by? But does anyone notice them the most of their life? No. Why? Because they're insignificant. You know, you breathe them in and you don't even notice. So that's what the world is to God. God is so great, he's so transcendent, that the whole of the universe is to him like a speck of dust. So that means all the created beings in the universe are also like a speck of dust. A speck of dust within a speck of dust, which is even smaller, if you could say such a thing. So what is going to make God notice anything? Right? The answer is, if there's something in the creation that has part of him directly there, then he will notice those beings, and they will can be the link between him and the rest of the creation, and that is the Jewish people. So all these created beings cannot get life force from God directly. They can only get their life force through souls that came up in God's thought before the world was created, and they were prior to the creation of the worlds. That worlds were created through God's speech. Who did God take advice from before he created the world? The souls of those righteous ones, as is known in another place. Now this, through these three lines, need a lot of explanation, because he's referring to ideas which are expanded very much elsewhere. So what he's saying is that, first of all, to establish the idea that the souls of the Jewish people were there in God's thought before creation. Now this all harps back to the very beginning of the first part of the Chumash, Bereshis. The beginning of the Chumash starts up, Bereshis bor elikim, eis ha-shamayim ve-eis ha-aretz. In the beginning God created heaven and earth. Now, Rashi, in the very beginning of the Chumash, tells us that it can't mean that. It can't mean in the beginning God created heaven and earth. Because that the Hebrew for that would be Barishayna. Barishayna bar elokim eis ha-shamayim ve-eis ha-aretz. That means at first God created heaven and earth. But the word Bereshis does not mean at the beginning. It means at the beginning of. Well, that causes a major problem. Because it doesn't say the beginning of what? It's like something. At the beginning of God created heaven and earth. That's not English. You've got to say the beginning of what? The beginning of the creation God created. But it doesn't say that. It says in the beginning of God created heaven and earth. So Rashi is very troubled by this. And he gives two explanations. The first explanation is that it's not saying in the beginning of it at all. It's saying this. Bereshis. Bezereshis. Bez means two. Is the number two. Because of two things, which are called Reshis in another context, that's why El Bore Elokim Eitz Hashemayim Ve'Eitz Haaretz. That's why God created heaven and earth. So the sentence now reads, because of two things which are called Reshis, that's why God created heaven and earth.
Okay.
A totally different meaning. What are these two things that are called Reshis? The two things called Reshis are the Jewish people and the Torah. So now the Torah is starting off giving us a reason for creation. Not the chronology of creation, that in the beginning God created heaven and earth. But the reason, which stands to reason, that God should give us a reason why he wants the world to create it. Because, you know, there's a mission going on here. There's an aim. So you have to know what the aim of the mission is before you can do it. You know, when soldiers, commandos are sent on a mission, they've got to be briefed beforehand to know you're being sent on a mission. So if we're not told that, we don't know we're on a mission. We're not even going to begin. So that's why the Torah starts out telling us we've got a mission. The whole of the universe was created because of two things called Reshis, the Jewish people and the Torah. That's explanation number one. Then Rashi gives another explanation which we don't need for the moment. But what are the ramifications of this? The ramifications of this are that the Jewish people and the Torah must have been there before the world was created. Because you can't have an aim before you have... You can't make something to achieve something before you have the achievement in your mind beforehand. You want... the aim has got to be there before you make the thing. You know, a person said, I'm going to build a house. What do you need out to live in? So first they have the concept, I need somewhere to live. That's in my mind. That's the aim, the final thing. Then you start building the house. You don't build a house aimlessly. Mm-hmm. Because, oh, I'm going to build a house. What for? I don't need a house. I've got a house already. Yeah? And the aim's got to be there. That's why it says, Saif Ma'aseh B'Machshava Techila. The end of the deed is only achieved with the prior thought. You know, you see that the first thought at the end of the deed, you see when the final, you know, knock of the hammer that's completed the thing that you're trying to make, then he's, that's what the designer was thinking of. You know, he's inventing an engine, the first railway engine. When you finally see the engine, now I understand what the guy was thinking of. He wanted somebody that moves of its own, with its own power. So now we have the idea that the Jewish people existed before the world was created. Now that's what he's talking about here. But of course it doesn't mean our bodies. Our bodies can't have been here before the world was created. Because our bodies are made from the dust. It says that God took the earth and made our bodies. So there had to be earth first. So that means there had to be something physical first. So it's not talking about our bodies. So what is it talking about? It's talking about our souls. So the souls of the Jewish people were there before the world was created. So that's why it says, these are the words he says over here. So he says, that they came up in God's thought. And they came there before the creation of the world. So God was thinking of us before he makes the creation, because we're the aim of creation. And how did he make the creation? Through Dibur, through speech. And then it says, it says, God took advice from the tzaddikim. The tzaddikim refers to the souls of the tzaddikim. It refers to the whole Jewish people. He took advice. What does it mean he took advice? He said, hello, you know, what do you think about this? What it means is he looked at the souls and saw that the souls would be tzaddikim. That means they would achieve their mission. And so he said, right, I'm going to create, because they're going to achieve their mission. That's what it means, nimlach. It doesn't mean, say, getting in a sort of, okay, boys, what are we going to do? Like, is that what we mean? He's taking advice? It means he's looking at what those souls that he has got with him, which are really part of him anyway, what are they going to achieve when he makes this creation? Will they do them? Will they achieve the mission? Yes, okay, I'm going to go ahead. That's what it means, Nimla. Kanaida b'makamachet. Okay, so what he's basically saying here is, I mean, we'll run out of time, really, because it's already getting 20 past 10. So he's using this idea of, what does it mean that God is in exile? Yeah? So because, this is what we started off with, this idea we started off with, that if, in a temporary phase, the souls of the Jewish people are not doing what we're supposed to do, we're not achieving what we're supposed to achieve, and that is a kind of exile for us, and therefore we were sent into exile. So in a certain sense, God is, he reflects that situation, he's also in exile. That means he's also not achieving his ultimate aim that he was trying to achieve, because it's not happening. Mm-hmm. So it's similar to what we were saying before as well, this idea that we're asleep, so he's asleep. We're not functioning, all of us, the way we ought to be functioning. His presence isn't manifesting the world the way it ought to be, because that was his aim, that his presence should be visible and manifest and tangible in this world. So we hope and pray that we are indeed near the end of our task. We're living in exile, but we are assured by many signs, and the Rebbe assured us in many, many times and many ways, that we're nearing the end of our mission. Okay. to bring God's presence in a real way on earth, which is the coming of Mashiach. That's what Mashiach is intending to do. Okay, so Mir Tashem will finish next week this chapter.